Oliver Loving and his companion, Cowboy Bill Wilson, were riding far ahead of the herd when the Comanche struck, forcing them to take refuge in a little bend on the Pecos River. Loving managed to kill the first warrior who exposed himself, after which the rest were a bit more cautious. Rather than risk a frontal assault, the Comanches simply commenced to rain down arrows. Still, though, despite holding off the attackers, both Loving and Wilson were wounded in the initial onslaught, with Loving getting the worst of it. The 54-year-old cattleman's wrist had been shattered by a bullet that passed clear through and lodged in his side. And as the siege continued, Loving's condition would only worsen, the pain and blood loss soon accompanied by a fever. During a moment of clarity, he persuaded the much younger Wilson to try to escape and locate help, saying that he would stand the Comanches off as best he could. The two shook hands, divvied up their ammo, and as soon as the moon went down, Wilson carefully removed his boots and slid into the Pecos. After letting the current carry him downstream a ways, he set off on a 3-day odyssey across the prairie, in search of that aforementioned herd of cattle, which, at that point in time, was being led by Oliver Loving's partner, Charles Goodnight. Upon laying eyes on Wilson, Goodnight would recount that he was the most terrible object he had ever seen. Quote, "His eyes were wild and bloodshot. His feet were swollen beyond all reason, and every step he took left blood in the track. I inquired about Loving, but he could scarcely make a reply, and what he did mutter was entirely unintelligible." End quote. As soon as Wilson could get the words out, he told Goodnight about what had transpired, and without wasting no more time, the former ranger hopped into the saddle and rode out in search of his friend. Quote, "I found where Mr. Loving had been in the ditch, which was now half filled with stones, and its banks perforated with probably 100 arrow shafts. I knew they had not got him, as there was ample evidence that they had been hunting for him everywhere. We searched down the river, but no tracks could be found. After dark, the party sadly made its way back to the herd and again took to the trail." End of quote. Now, it may seem curious that Goodnight just abandoned the search, but then again, Loving had told Wilson that he would kill himself rather than to fall into the hands of the Comanche. After all, Loving was a veteran of the frontier and he knew damn well what he had coming if he were to be captured. I guess Goodnight figured that his partner had done just that and his body had simply been washed downriver. Little did he know that Oliver Loving was still alive. Turns out that after Wilson escaped, Loving had continued to keep the hostiles at bay. Then, 3 days after the attack began, he emerged from his river barricade and managed to make 6 miles on foot before collapsing. Finally, after something like 6 or 7 days without food, Loving was spotted by a passerby who rushed him 150 miles to Fort Sumner. It wasn't until 2 weeks later that Goodnight would learn of his friend's whereabouts. As the herd was still some 30-odd miles away from the fort, a courier rode out bearing the news. Said that gangrene had infected Loving's arm and he was putting off having it amputated until Goodnight arrived. Unfortunately, by that time, the poison had done set in. Still, though, Goodnight demanded that the doctor amputate, which he did, but like I said, it weren't no use. Oliver Loving, as tough as he was simply too far gone. Gave up the ghost shortly thereafter on September 25th, 1867. Per Charles Goodnight, quote, "In spite of neglect, starvation, and punishment, he lived for 22 days, perfectly rational to the last when his mind returned to Texas." End quote. Indeed, there towards the end, Loving expressed regret at having to be buried in New Mexico, so Goodnight assured him that he'd see to it that his remains were brought back home to Texas. And although Oliver was initially planted there at Fort Sumner, Charles Goodnight was true to his word, returned a few months later, and had his partner exhumed. He then placed Loving in a specially made tin casket, packed it full of charcoal, and began the long journey back home, nearly 400 miles through hostile territory. Now, if any of this sounds familiar, there's a very good chance you've seen Lonesome Dove, or you've read the book that it's based on, or both. But did you know that there are many other aspects of Lonesome Dove that were also inspired by real-life people and events? Join me today as we dive into the true story behind this most epic of tales. We'll also discuss a little Lonesome Dove trivia along the way. My name's Josh, and this is the Wild West Extravaganza. I don't know about you, but I cannot remember the first time I saw Lonesome Dove. It's just always sort of been a presence in my life. Growing up, we watched it religiously. Literally any time it was on TV and my dad had the remote, that's what we were watching. I didn't pick the book up until I was around maybe 16, and even though I already knew how it ended, I finished it within a matter of days. And once I was done, I started all over at the very beginning. Throughout the years, I've read Lonesome Dove cover to cover, at very least a dozen times. And I've returned to it and read select portions probably 100 times. Same goes for the movie. Suffice it to say, this story, along with its characters, have been constant companions of mine since childhood. Now, we're going to get to the real history in a moment, but just in case, consider this your spoiler alert. If you have not yet seen or read Lonesome Dove, pause this immediately and go get yourself a copy. You can thank me later. Yeah, it's a Western, but you don't necessarily have to be a fan of that particular genre to enjoy Lonesome Dove. At its most basic, it's a study of humanity, a work of philosophy masquerading as a story about cowboys. It is, in my opinion, the greatest tale ever told. And like I teased a minute ago, many aspects of Lonesome Dove were based on real-life people and events. Remember, spoiler alert, but as I'm sure you've already figured out, the death of Oliver Loving greatly resembles that of the fictional Augustus McCrae. Billy Wilson's trek across the prairie sounds an awful lot like the one endured by P.I. Parker. And then, of course, you've got Captain Call's return to Texas with Gus's remains, just like Charles Goodnight did with Oliver Loving. But did you know that much like Gus and Call, Charlie Goodnight had also spent quite a bit of time as a Texas Ranger? Born on March 5th, 1836, just a day prior to the fall of the Alamo, Goodnight would first set foot in Texas in 1845 as a 9-year-old boy. About a decade later, he began running cattle with his brother-in-law, and by 1857, he had settled in Palo Pinto County. It's there where he would meet his future partner, Oliver Loving, as well as join the Texas Rangers. In time, he would even scout for the Rangers. Hell, in 1860, it was Goodnight who led his compadres to a Comanche camp on the Pease River, about 30 miles southwest of present-day Vernon, Texas. During the battle that ensued, Chief Peter Nakona was killed, and his wife, Cynthia Ann Parker, was air quotes rescued. I've actually been there, by the way, where the Battle of Pease River was fought. Very underwhelming. Don't get me wrong, it's cool to stand there in the same place as many of these historical figures, but the actual site, as far as I could tell, was located on private property behind a locked gate. Couldn't even see the river. All that's accessible to the public appears to just be a small marker off the side of a dirt road. It is beautiful country, though. Very much a stomping ground of the Comanche, and within spitting distance of the Medicine Mounds. This is land that Charles Goodnight would come to know intimately as a ranger, especially once the Civil War began. Rather than head east and fight Yankees, Charlie instead remained out west with the newly formed Frontier Regiment of the Texas Rangers. Operating mostly out of Fort Belknap, it was Goodnight's job to help protect the remaining settlers from hostile raids. Following the war, Charles would resume his career as a cattleman and even start a brand new ranch up in Throckmorton County. A venture not without problems, as the Comanche and Kiowas had a field day running off with his cattle. Still, Goodnight persevered and slowly began rebuilding his herd. Now, during this period, beef was in high demand over in New Mexico at the various Indian agencies. That being the case, in 1866, Charlie and his buddy Oliver Loving, along with 18 cowboys, trailed their combined herds of around 2,000 longhorn from Texas all the way to Fort Sumner. They headed south from Jack County till they struck the Pecos, then followed it west and north up into New Mexico, and finally, Fort Sumner. And yeah, that is the same Fort Sumner where Billy the Kid would meet his demise 15 years later. Of course, back in 1866, it was still being used as an actual military installation. This 700-mile journey, nearly 100 of which passed through the waterless Staked Plains, would later extend all the way north to Wyoming and come to be known as the Goodnight Loving Trail. By the way, it was during that initial trip to New Mexico when the famous chuck wagon was first used, named after the man who invented it, our very own Charles Goodnight. And of course, sadly, it was on the third trip when Loving was ambushed by them warriors. Following Loving's death, Goodnight would go on to be the first man to ever run cattle in Palo Duro Canyon, an area that was once a stronghold of his enemies, the Comanche. Matter of fact, it was there in the canyon in the spring of 1878 where Goodnight and Quanah Parker would meet for the very first time. Quanah, by the way, was the son of the previously mentioned Peter Nakona and Cynthia Ann Parker. By 1878, the Comanches had been relegated to the reservation, but Quanah had received permission to take a small party south to hunt for buffalo. Imagine their surprise when none could be located. Now make no mistake about it, They knew that the hide hunters had wreaked havoc on the buffalo, but it was still hard for these lords of the southern plains to wrap their heads around the fact that they were gone completely. So they kept looking, continuing southward all the way into the Texas Panhandle and finally Palo Duro Canyon. Still failing to locate any buffalo, Quanah and his men instead took to butchering cattle. And when Charlie Goodnight rode out to meet him and explained that these were his cows that they were eating, Quanah responded by telling Goodnight that he was standing on land belonging to the Comanche. I guess they figured our land, our cattle. This tense conversation continued for several minutes until finally Quanah asked Goodnight what he had to offer, to which Goodnight replied, quote, I've got plenty of guns and plenty of bullets, good men and good shots, but I don't want to fight unless you force me, end quote. He then invited Quanah to stick around, take his time, and see for himself that the buffalo were indeed all gone. And what's more, while he and his men searched, they could help themselves to a good night's beeves for each day they were there. Despite Charlie spending the better part of 2 decades fighting the Comanche, he and Quanah would become lifelong friends. This meeting there in the Palo Duro was just the beginning of a relationship that would last until the chief's death in 1910. Interestingly enough, speaking of buffalo, later in life, Goodnight would help to save what was left of the American bison from utter annihilation. Ended up capturing a few of the scant remaining buffalo there in the Panhandle and raised them on his ranch. This herd would grow and in time would be used to stock other herds as far away as Montana and even Canada. I'm told that if you visit the Caprock Canyons, you'll see a herd of buffalo directly descended from those that Goodnight saved. So yeah, on top of being a Texas Ranger, I think it's pretty obvious that a lot of Goodnight's stoicism and dogged toughness can be found in the character of Woodrow F. Call. And believe it or not, that last line in the film version of Lonesome Dove, where the journalist is asking Call if he's a man of vision, that came straight out of Goodnight's mouth in a 1926 interview conducted by J. Frank Dobie. Quote, someone said that you have been a man of vision. Yes, Goodnight retorted, a hell of a vision. Now, it wasn't just Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving who helped to influence Lonesome Dove. If you're not already familiar with this next little tidbit, I think there's a good chance it might just blow your mind. Joining Goodnight and Loving on the trail to New Mexico was a black cowboy by the name of Bose Icard. Born a slave in the 1840s, Bose went to work for Oliver Loving shortly after emancipation. Turned out to be one hell of a hand, and following Loving's death in 1867, Bose continued to work for Goodnight. Years later, Charlie would say of Icard, quote, I've trusted him further than any living man. He was my detective, banker, and everything else in Colorado, New Mexico, and the other wild country I was in, end quote. Starting to sound a little familiar, right? Kind of like Dietz from Lonesome Dove. And while Bose would not fall prey to a hostile's lance, he and Dietz's grave markers were eerily similar. Upon Icard's passing in 1928, Charles Goodnight commissioned a stone that read the following. Bose Icard, served with me 4 years on the Goodnight Loving Trail, never shirked a duty or disobeyed an order, rode with me in many stampedes, participated in 3 engagements with the Comanche, splendid behavior. Damn near word for word when you compare it to Captain Call's fictional epitaph for old Josh Dietz. But what about that cattle drive from Texas all the way to Montana? Fair enough question, considering that it's one of the main plot lines of Lonesome Dove. And truth be told, neither Goodnight nor Loving, or even Bose Icard for that matter, would ever make it that far north. That said, there was a guy by the name of Nelson Story who accomplished just that. The Ohio native traveled to Montana in 1863, looking to strike it rich at Alder's Gulch. And believe it or not, Story was one of the few who actually did strike it rich. Kind of. His claim paid off and produced around $30,000 worth of gold, a little over $700,000 in today's money. Now, Story was still a young man in his 20s at this time, and for most people that age, 700 large, although nice to have, ain't gonna last no lifetime, or more importantly, the lifetime of your future children. Smart thing to do would be put some of that money to work, right? And, well, that's exactly what Nelson Story did. Took 10 grand down to Texas and purchased 1,000 head of Longhorn cattle. He then hired a crew of about 2 dozen meaner and hell cowboys, armed them with repeating rifles, and in April of 1866, pointed them north, determined to be the first man to ever deliver a herd all the way up to the Big Sky country. The entire trip would take 7 months as they covered over 1,500 miles, straight through Lakota territory just as Red Cloud's war was reaching a fever pitch. They were first attacked a few miles south of Fort Reno. Nelson and his men stood their ground, but the warriors were able to make off with at least a few head. Didn't hang on to them, though. According to one of Story's men, quote, "We just followed those Indians into the Badlands and took the cattle back," end quote. Like I said, meaner in hell. Next stop was Fort Phil Kearny, where they'd briefly be detained for what Colonel Carrington said was for their own good. For the better part of 2 weeks, Nelson Story just sat there watching his cow shit before finally bidding the army an unsanctioned adieu and resuming the drive. And just to give you an idea of how dangerous this was, just 2 months later is when the Fetterman Massacre would go down, right there at Fort Kearny. Or I guess I should say, right over the ridge from Fort Kearny. As for Nelson and the herd, they took to traveling only at night, but still endure at least 2 more attacks from the hostiles. Finally, in December of 66, they reached the area where Livingston, Montana now stands. And it's there where Story would build his ranch. He ended up selling a good deal of the cattle over in Bozeman for 10 times what he paid for them at Fort Worth, by the way, and used the remainder to stock his spread. And from there, he would only continue to accumulate wealth. Hell, it wasn't long before Nelson Story would become the very first millionaire to reside in Bozeman, Montana. Decades later, one of the men who accompanied this historic cattle drive, John Catlin, had this to say about Story. Quote, "I've never seen a fighting man like Nelson Story. He hunted a fight, and when he found it, he knew how to handle it. He never carried a rifle, but there were always 2 big Navy Colts on his hips. He was always splendidly mounted and would ride like the wind. He'd say, 'Come on, boys,' and ride away. Of course, we'd follow him. We'd have followed him to hell." End of quote. Remember Blue Duck from Lonesome Dove? That damn renegade scoundrel? Well, as it turns out, there was a real-life outlaw by the same name. An Indian outlaw, to be exact. Half Cherokee and Choctaw. His baby, per sources, was a Chippewa, one of a kind. Legend has it that Mr. Duck could be found almost any given night in his wigwam, beating on his tom-tom. No! Get out of here, Tim McGraw! Sorry about that. In all actuality, yes, the real Blue Duck was a Cherokee outlaw, or at least part Cherokee, operating out of Indian territory and possibly romantically involved at one point or another with the lady bandit, Belle Starr. Other than the indigenous angle, though, there really ain't much of a similarity. Even the book's author, Larry McMurtry, stated that them having the same name was just a coincidence. That said, there's just no denying that Blue Duck's demise was based on the death of a very real Kiowa chief called Satanta. I did an episode on Satanta many moons ago. I'll leave a link down in the show notes if you're interested, but long story short, much like the fictional Blue Duck, he was a pretty scary dude. Not somebody you'd want to bump into out on the prairie. Born into the Kiowa Nation circa 1819, Satanta not only came to be known for his prowess in battle, but also his great oratory skills. Fancy speeches aside, Satanta would continue raiding well into his middle age and would eventually be captured and condemned to hang. Miraculously, the old warrior's sentence was commuted, and then he'd be paroled altogether in 1873, after which he went right back on the warpath, mostly as an advisor, but didn't matter none. The authorities there in Texas were fed up with hostilities, so this time, they locked Satanta up for good over in the Huntsville State Penitentiary. It was there, on October 11th, 1878, that he took a flying leap out of a third-floor prison window, much like Blue Duck's final flight in Lonesome Dove. As far as other real-life influences, Lonesome Dove author Larry McMurtry also drew inspiration from a Texas cowboy named Teddy Blue Abbott. McMurtry considered Abbott's book, We Pointed Them North, to be a superb memoir and that coupled with, quote, Haley's biography of Goodnight, Irwin Smith's book of range photographs, and a volume of J.R. Williams' cowboy cartoons, one could figure out just about anything one might need to know about the 19th century cowboy, end quote. And shout out to my friend Michael over at Texas History Lessons podcast for sharing that little citation with me. Another possible inspiration behind Lonesome Dove that doesn't get a whole lot of recognition is Juan Cortina. Considered a bandit by the Texans and a folk hero to the Mexicans, Cortina likely helped to influence the character of Pedro Flores. Over the years, Cortina would have many a clash with the Texas Rangers, along with cattle ranchers like Richard King. If you'll remember, it was the fictional Pedro's Ranch, where Woodrow and Gus stole all them horses and a good deal of the cattle that they would drive to Montana. Kinda ironic, considering the fate of Jake Spoon, but I guess back in those days, being an outlaw just sorta depended on which side of the river you were on. Then there was the real-life cowboys that McMurtry knew as a child. He came from a ranching family in Texas, grew up on stories of the old breed, and knew firsthand what it was like to sit a saddle. Just one for him, though. Rather than follow the family into the cattle herding business, McMurtry instead chose to be what he described as a word herder. If you'd like to learn more about this great man, I'll drop a link below to the Texas History Lessons episode on Larry McMurtry. I'll also link to the episode that Michael did covering the various cattle trails in Texas, including the Goodnight Loving Trail. Like I said, you can find that down in the show notes or over at TexasHistoryLessons.com. Did you know that Lonesome Dove was originally supposed to be a John Wayne movie? I'm not making this up. Before it was a novel, it was just a screenplay. The Duke was slated to star as Woodrow F. Call, Jimmy Stewart as Augustus McCrae, and Henry Fonda as Jake Spoon. Even the plot was different. Rather than being a trail driving movie, Gus and Call were mere pig farmers, mostly just sitting on the porch complaining. Luckily, John Wayne backed out and the movie was canceled. Years later, McMurtry fleshed out the script and it became what's now Lonesome Dove. Listen, I love John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart. Two of my favorite westerns of all time, The Shootist and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, stars both of them. But thank God they were not involved with Lonesome Dove. And that's no knock on either one of these great actors. It just wouldn't have been the same. I don't think anybody could have pulled off what Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones did. They literally became Gus and Call, embodying these characters to perfection. And really, if you think about it, the same goes for the rest of the cast. Ricky Schroeder was perfect as Newt. Likewise for Danny Glover in the role of Dietz, and Diane Lane's portrayal of Lorena. Hell, I think we all fell in love with her. I even enjoyed Frederick Forrest in the role of Blue Duck, a choice that would end up causing a bit of drama there on set. It was supposed to be Charles Bronson playing Blue Duck, but he had prior engagements. Then Robert Duvall had a friend of his, a genuine full-blooded Comanche, that he was hoping to fill the spot with, but I guess the casting directors felt differently and they chose Frederick Forrest, who, in my opinion, did one hell of a job. That said, nobody asked me, and apparently this decision did not sit well with old Robert Duvall. Story goes that he refused to even so much as rehearse with Forrest, so when they had that scene where Gus and Blue Duck first meet, you know, where Gus is sitting on that rock in the river and Blue Duck just slowly comes riding down, that was their first time ever interacting with one another. And ultimately, it worked out great for us, the viewers. Just added a little extra tension. What a great scene, by the way. Gus just casually sitting there in the river, wearing nothing but his long johns and pistol, telling Blue Duck that he hopes he likes the water cold because he ain't got time to warm it up for him. And what's Blue Duck say? I like it wet. So many great quotes from Lonesome Dove, man. I mean, just that scene alone comes right after Gus's speech to Lorena. You know the one, about life over in San Francisco. We'll get to that in just a little bit, but since we're on the subject of Robert Duvall, it's worth pointing out that this was not the only time he was responsible for creating a little bit of extra friction on the set of Lonesome Dove. According to Danny Glover, quote, "Some actors need tension to feed off of, but I did hear some language that I had never heard an actor throw at a director before," end quote. He's referring, of course, to Robert Duvall and director Simon Windsor. Not only did they butt heads, but at one point, Duvall threatened to bite Windsor's nose off. Not making that up. I believe his exact words were, "I'll bite your fucking nose off." Also, just between me and you, Duvall would allegedly take shits in the fake outhouses on set just in order not to break character. The director, Simon Windsor, would later state that while it's no secret he and Duvall had their moments, that he didn't care because the end result was fantastic. And I could not agree more. One of the rare times that the film version lives up to the book. And let's be honest, it's the book that's the real masterpiece. I can sit here and sing the praises of Duvall and Jones all day long. They are the goats, okay? The people in charge of the costumes and props, the wranglers, the various advisors, the cameramen, everybody else involved with Lonesome Dove was amazing. But at the end of the day, it's Larry McMurtry who truly deserves the lion's share of the credit. And if you haven't already read the book, I would urge you to at least consider it. There are some really great scenes that never even made it into the movie. For instance, remember that army scout that Captain Call beats down after he quirts Newt? "I hate rude behavior in a man. I won't tolerate it." There's a part in the book prior to that, before they ever get to town, where the army had tried to requisition several of their horses in addition to taking Dietz. Gus and Call tell him to kick rocks, and there's damn near a gunfight right there on the prairie. Just even more of a build-up to when they finally arrive in Ogallala. Some of the most memorable dialogue of the book, and it never even made it to the movie. Then there's the character of Will Barger. He doesn't make it to the movie either. Well, I take that back. He kinda does, but it's just for like a split second. Bonus points if you know who he is in the movie. but I thought that his various interactions with Gus in the book were highly entertaining and very insightful. Gives a little bit of an extra dimension to Augustus. Now, you may not know this, but Lonesome Dove is just one installment in a four-part series. There is a sequel, Streets of Laredo, as well as two prequels, Dead Man's Walk and Comanche Moon. My recommendation would be that you read them in the order they were published. Start with the original, Lonesome Dove, followed by Streets of Laredo. As far as I'm concerned, these are both masterpieces. Then, once you're done with those, that's when you go back and read the prequels, Dead Man's Walk and Comanche Moon. Like I said, this is just my recommendation, okay? It's a free country and Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. They're all good books, but Dead Man's Walk and Comanche Moon just don't have quite the same magic as Lonesome Dove and Streets of Laredo. I will warn you, though, Larry McMurtry is no great respecter of fill-ins, and he wasn't much given to happy endings. So don't go getting upset at the fate of certain beloved characters. We all die in the end, right? And if we're characters in a Larry McMurtry novel, we might die in ways you couldn't even possibly imagine. Worth mentioning that the movie Return to Lonesome Dove is not considered canon or a part of the true Lonesome Dove universe. Same goes for Lonesome Dove the series and Lonesome Dove Outlaw Years. I've seen them long time ago when I was a kid. Shout out to Reese Witherspoon. There's nothing wrong with them per se as westerns, but just know that Larry McMurtry had absolutely nothing to do with them. He did not write those shows, and the plot lines were not his idea. And besides, I don't want to give too much away, but if you've read Streets of Laredo, which is the official sequel to Lonesome Dove, you'll understand why the plot of Return to Lonesome Dove is pretty much impossible. Remember what I said about McMurtry and happy endings. As far as his other books, I won't sit here and pretend like I've read all of them, but I have enjoyed all of the ones I've read. Once you're done with the Lonesome Dove Tetralogy, I think that's what smart people say when there's four of something, and you're looking for additional books by Larry McMurtry, I do have suggestions. I thought that The Last Kind Word Saloon and Telegraph Days were both pretty solid. There's also Buffalo Gals and Anything for Billy. If you're just looking for some all-around great storytelling that's not set in the Old West, you might check out the Duane Moore series, starting with The Last Picture Show all the way up to Rhino Ranch. Really good stuff. And then there's McMurtry's essays. One of the ones I own that I'm currently reading is titled In a Narrow Grave. Fun fact, Larry McMurtry helped to write Brokeback Mountain. I'm not familiar with all the details, but he did assist longtime collaborator Diana Ossana with the script. That's another thing. You cannot box Larry McMurtry in. The man wrote what the hell he wanted to write, plain and simple. Well before Lonesome Dove, he scandalized his own hometown with The Last Picture Show, a novel that featured quite a bit of controversial sexual activity, and not all of it between humans, if you catch my drift. Even Lonesome Dove was meant to be a critique, an anti-Western. In an interview with Terry Gross, McMurtry stated, quote, I thought that the Western myth, or the myth of the cowboy, was very powerful. I thought that Lonesome Dove was, in a way, a critique of it because I grew up with cowboys, I respect them up to a point, but I'm not crazy about them. And I know I think something of their limitations having grown up with them. So I didn't set out to write a book which glorified the myth of the West. I didn't particularly set out to write a book that debunked it either. You know, I was telling a story of three men who had been friends for a long time and got caught up in an adventure, and the book was a description of that adventure and its consequences. End quote. On yet another occasion, McMurtry stated that a lot of bad things happen in Lonesome Dove, and that a lot of them are not nice. They are not civilized. The whole book is permeated with criticism of the Old West from start to finish. Also, rather than good night and loving, he asserted that the true models for Call and Gus were Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, with Gus being the romantic adventurer and Call being the pragmatic realist. Now, I'm about to wrap things up, but I've got an assignment for you, should you choose to accept it. It's real easy. I just want you to share your favorite quote from Lonesome Dove. If you're listening via Spotify or on YouTube, drop them in the comments. Or just email me at josh@wildwestextra.com. Just whatever your favorite quotes are, either from the book or the movie. You know, lines like, I won't say I did and I won't say I didn't, but I will say that a man who wouldn't cheat for a poke don't want one bad enough. I'd like to see the herd that you and Jake could gather. A herd of whores, maybe. You having possum for supper, are you? You ever bring that tongue of yours north of the Canadian River, I'll cut it off and feed it to my wolf pups. Woodrow, you just don't get the point. It ain't dying I'm talking about. It's living. You ever et frog? I can whack it if I want to. You see, life in San Francisco is still just life. If you want any one thing too badly, it'll likely turn out to be a disappointment. The only healthy way to live is to learn to like all of the little everyday things, like a sip of good whiskey in the evening, a soft bed, a glass of buttermilk, or a feisty gentleman like myself. All right, you get the picture. Hit me with your best Lonesome Dove quotes. Just a quick correction before we go. On the last installment of the Lewis and Clark series, I mentioned that Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, the son of Sacagawea, died after getting soaked in the Owyhee River in northern Nevada. That is incorrect. It was the Owyhee River, but it just wasn't there in northern Nevada. It was in southeastern Oregon. Apparently, this occurred where the Jordan Creek meets the Owyhee, and Pomp was able to make it another 25 miles to Inskip Station, where he passed away and was ultimately buried. So not northern Nevada, but southeastern Oregon. Looks like the final resting place is just outside of Danner, Oregon. Thanks to Aaron Plain and everybody else for pointing that out. Okay, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for all your support. Please head on over to wildwestextra.com for more true tales from the wild and woolly west. Next week, we're going to be diving into the life and times of Tom Horn. Oh, yeah, about to get all Tom Horny up in this bitch. Till next time, make sure you tend your biscuits, watch where you wiggle that carrot, and here's to the sunny slopes of long ago. Adios. I can whack it if I want to.